My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook, a domestic servant to the British. But my grandfather had larger dreams for his son. Through hard work and perseverance, my father got a scholarship to study in a magical place, America.
America's new president telling his life story in the keynote address to the 2004 Democratic Convention in Boston. Barack Obama's story has become familiar to the whole world. His improbable journey has been at the heart of his political message during the long 22 months of his campaign. But Obama's biography translates into more than just a campaign theme. It provides crucial clues as to how he thinks, what drives him, and how he operates. To understand the man whose decisions will now shape the world for at least the next 4 years, you need to know where he came from and the path he has travelled. I'm Jonathan Friedland, and this is Barack Obama, The Road to the White House. In this programme, we'll hear from The Guardian's team of international correspondents who've been to visit the many places that played a part in Obama's journey.
When he told us that he was going to run for the United States Senate, we said, look, you know, Barack, this is crazy. Forget about politics, give it up, and just join our faculty full time.
He brought the baby crocodile, baptized them to show the baby crocodile to them, and then the boys ran away from this.
It's a trait that his grandfather had for greatness. His father had it, and now he has it. The fact that he's going to become the president is not so much a big deal as that he's able to be the person he is.
From the mud-hutted villages of Kenya to the dirt paths of Jakarta, from the endless beaches of Hawaii to the broken streets of Chicago's South Side, we'll hear the strange and confusing tale that Obama himself had to work so hard to untangle, and which has made him the man elected as the 44th President of the United States. Barack Obama was born in Hawaii in August 1961. His mother, Ann Dunham, was from Kansas. Her father, Stanley, had been born into a small town during the Great Depression, but he dreamed bigger. He eloped with his sweetheart, Madeline, enlisted after Pearl Harbor, and fought in General Patton's army in France. He then headed west, always hoping for something better, from Texas to California, and finally, when offered a job as a furniture salesman in America's newest state, to Hawaii, where they raised their daughter Anne. In 1960, she enrolled at the University of Hawaii to study maths, and it was here that she met Barack Obama Sr., a 23-year-old student from Kenya and the university's first black student. Barack Sr.'s family came from a remote village in the far west of Kenya. His father, Hussein Onyango Obama, had caused a sensation as a child when he wandered off to visit a village where the first white men had arrived. One day he returned home, causing outrage by wearing not the traditional goat skin around his waist, but trousers, a shirt, and shoes. His wandering spirit eventually led to a job as a cook for a British army captain during the Second World War. His son, Barack, was a mischievous and playful boy. Those who knew him said he'd inherited three of Hussein's most striking traits: stubbornness, independence, and a striking intellect. He studied by correspondence course, working hard, applying in 1959 to a long list of American universities. One said yes, the University of Hawaii. He met Anne, fell in love, and in 1961 they had a child. He too would be called Barack Hussein Obama. Although Barack Obama Jr. was not to spend much time with his father, Mama Sarah, Hussein's third wife, and now the step-grandmother of America's new president, sees similarities in these three generations of men. Guardian correspondent Zan Rice visited Mama Sarah's modest house in the town of Kogilo in West Kenya. She spoke through an interpreter.
His grandfather always told the truth. He said things as they were. Somebody was very, very keen on progress and development, and basically insisted on it that, you know, people look after themselves, develop themselves, make sure that they're able to stand on their own two feet. He was also very keen on education and educating yourself and improving your mind. So those are the traits that she sees that Barack also has.
But what about from Barack Obama Sr.? Are there any traits that he had that you see in Barack now?
She's saying, first and foremost, the voice already, because Barack's voice is very much like his father's. She says that when she hears the voice, it makes her think Barack Sr. has come back from the dead. The other thing is just the keenness on developing people, moving them forward, in particular through education. His father was one that if he saw a young person or a child who's not going to school, he would get some money and say, look, you've got to go to school, you've got to better yourself, you've got to improve your life.
With Barack Obama Sr. now gone, Anne Dunham's affections soon transferred to another foreign student at the University of Hawaii, an Indonesian named Lolo. Restless, Anne decided to leave Honolulu so that she and her son, now barely six, could be with her new husband and start a new life in the East. She arrived in Indonesia in a spirit of blissful innocence that her son would later marvel at with something less than admiration. Anne seemed only vaguely aware that the country was in turmoil, that just a few months earlier a coup attempt had been thwarted and hundreds of thousands of people killed. Always wide-eyed and hopeful, she believed that any individual could shape their own future, regardless of whatever barriers history or geography might put in the way. By all accounts, the young Obama, Barry Soetoro, as he was then, taking the name of his stepfather, embraced his new surroundings with enthusiasm. It was an uphill task for a six-year-old boy to get on in an alien culture where he knew not a word of the language. But, as Guardian correspondent Ian McKinnon discovered, the young Barry with an Indonesian lilt, displayed winning ways.
Children playing in the yard of Obama's St. Francis Assisi Catholic School. It was his first school, a stone's throw from the family's humble home in a village on Jakarta's outskirts. In a pond, Obama and his stepfather kept turtles and a baby crocodile. Amid the dusty lanes, he played soccer, swam in a muddy pond to his mother's annoyance, and trapped dragonflies. Early on, his stepfather taught him he must be strong, a message he took to heart to protect his neighborhood friends. Playmate Ronnie Amir.
You know, when we play together, there's some country boy come to us and then they try to disturb our game. And then Barry get angry and then he came to his house and then he brought the baby crocodile and then he teased them, Barry teased them to show the baby crocodile to them and then the boys ran away from this.
Yet Obama was on the receiving end occasionally. Then his favourite Indonesian word was kamacharang, cheat, when his sense of fair play was offended. Harman Askier still lives in the house where Obama played after school, and recalls one time when Barry was justifiably aggrieved but took the joke in his stride.
Saya mengganggu Barry dengan coklat itu kan, ya Barry.
I teased him with chocolates once.
Okay.
Barry, do you like chocolates? Okay. He said yes, and I gave him one. Next day I did the same thing. Then, third day, I asked if he liked chili chocolate, which he'd had, but I gave him chili paste that looked the same. It burned his mouth and he screamed, cheat, but he was okay about it.
Away from the childhood hijinks, Obama's teachers recall a precocious leadership talent. Of his own volition, the dark-skinned Obama, taller and chubbier than his Indonesian classmates, lined them up before they started class, giving instructions in rudimentary Indonesian. But in a poem assignment titled My Dreams, Obama displayed ambition beyond his years. His first teacher, Israela Pereira.
Dia tulis bahwa ibunya adalah sebagai idolanya. Dia sangat bangga.
In his poem, Barry wrote that he wanted to be a president. He didn't say any specific
country,
but he made it clear he wanted to be a president.
Dia ingin menjadi presiden.
In the world's most populous Islamic country, Barry Sotoro's school registered him a Muslim after his father's religion. Early in the presidential election battle, right-wing groups in the US tried to smear Obama by portraying his next government school as a madrasa. It was a lie. In fact, Basuki's school was a tolerant religious melting pot run by a Protestant spinster. Classmate Ruli Dasad.
When I think back, you know, at that time is the time when all of us learning everything, like sharing among other kids. There are different ethnics, different religion in our class at the time. There are Hindu kids, Muslim kids, Christian kids, Catholic kids. But we are very strong in unity. I think that is the great experience in our life, forming our personality also.
By the time he was 10, Barack Obama was back in Hawaii. His mother had decided he needed to go to an American school, and she sent him over to live with his grandparents. She would follow the next year. Today, Michelle Obama says that the adolescence her husband experienced in Honolulu holds the key to his personality. You can't really understand Barack until you understand Hawaii, she said. Some speculate that it's Hawaii that explains the languid cool that is so striking in Obama. Yet his own account describes an upbringing that was not all placid serenity. His grandfather was frustrated with a luckless career as an insurance salesman. His mother was absent, eventually returning to Indonesia, even though her second marriage had fallen apart, to do fieldwork on a doctoral dissertation in anthropology. It fell to Obama's grandmother to provide some stability. The woman he called Tut was a model of Kansan constancy. While Stanley's career sputtered, she held down a senior job in banking, then all but unknown for a woman, which paid for Obama to be educated, privately and expensively. Barry went to Panole School, a 17-acre oasis of calm, order and privilege, tucked behind a low stone wall topped with cacti. But in Obama's own telling, this was a period of unease, a time when the inner wrestling with race and his own identity began in earnest, as he sought to understand his place as a black youth raised by white grandparents in a far-flung corner of the United States where there were few African Americans around. Alan Lum was a former classmate on the basketball team with Obama and now teaches at Panole. The Guardian's Dan Glaister went to visit him and asked how the school had shaped the young Barack.
His experience at Panole and living in Hawaii kind of shaped and gave him the skill sets and, you know, the values to be where he is today. I mean, we live in a multicultural society in Hawaii, and at Panole we had a diverse student population with many opportunities that kind of facilitate and nurture.
Now, a lot of people have drawn the parallel between the sort of relaxed air on this island and how he seems to cope with stress and pressure. He seems that there's almost an out-of-body sort of thing going on with him sometimes.
I think it's confidence, knowing that he's prepared all he could do to be ready for it. And I think that's what we learned through basketball at Panole, where Coach John Wooden always talked about, if you fail to prepare, prepare to fail. You know, I think Senator Obama, in his dealings in the presidency and the debates, he's going to prepare himself to the point where, you know, he's probably over-prepared.
In his memoir, Dreams from My Father, he talks about the sort of inner turmoil that he was going through in terms of his identity at the time. Was any of that apparent to you, or were you surprised to read about that later?
I was definitely surprised to read about that. For me, myself, I thought it was a lost opportunity to, you know, reach out for him in that situation. But we never knew, we didn't see it.
Barack had little contact with his father as he grew up in Hawaii. Barack Sr. visited the island and his son just once in 1971. In his biography, Dreams from My Father, Barack Obama describes the confusion and mixed feelings he felt during this visit.
There, in the unlit hallway, I saw him, a tall, dark figure who walked with a slight limp. He crouched down and put his arms around me, and I let my arms hang at my side. He led me by the hand into the living room, and we all sat down. I watched him carefully as the adults began to talk. He was much thinner than I had expected, the bones of his knees cutting the legs of his trousers in sharp angles. I couldn't imagine him lifting anyone off the ground. My mother suggested that he looked tired and should take a nap, and he agreed. He gathered up his travel bag, then stopped in mid-stride and began to fish around in it until he finally pulled out three wooden figurines, a lion, an elephant, and an ebony man in tribal dress beating a drum. He handed them to me. "Say thank you, Bar," my mother said. "Thank you," I muttered. My father and I both looked down at the carvings, lifeless in my hands. He touched my shoulder. "They are only small things," he said softly. Then he nodded to Gramps, and together they gathered up his luggage and went downstairs to the other apartment.
Back in Kenya, Obama Sr. landed a prestige post in the Ministry of Economic Planning. Barack Sr. was known for his intelligence, but he could also be imperious, even cruel, and given to boasting about his brains and his wealth. And he was too fond of a drink. alcohol was to be Obama Sr.'s final undoing. He died in the last of a series of serious car accidents in 1982. Barack Obama Jr. knew only the basic details of his extended family in Kenya. They, however, had heard a lot about him.
Growing up, I always knew about my brother Barack because my father always talked about him. So we had photos of him as he was growing up. I've got photos of Barack when he was a toddler, you know, when he was a little boy. We knew that he was in America, and we always knew that someday he'd come home because my father always said he would.
Alma Obama, Barack's half-sister. After his father's death, Barack made contact with Alma in Germany, and in 1988 he flew to Kenya for the first time, where Alma introduced him to his Kenyan relatives, including many of his half-siblings.
We had so much fun. It was just fun. And, you know, it's an attribute to Barack's character. Barack came here, and you have the feeling Barack came and he knew he was coming home. He didn't have any of these, you know, hang-ups of, oh, you know, it's a pit toilet, or there are mosquitoes, or oh, there's this strange big bug. He just was. You know, we talked a lot. We spent a lot of time talking. It was like going through the secret garden and discovering a new plant here, a new plant there, and watching it bloom and talking about its colors. And it was fun. It was adventurous, even if it was sometimes scary. I remember we went to the coast, and the trip coming back, we went by bus because obviously we didn't have any money to fly, and I was so scared. I was just terrified.
Coming back from Mombasa to Nairobi,
and Barack was quite calm about it. He took it all in his stride and was like, you know, one big deal. And I, the Kenyan who should be used to all this, was furious at the driver, and a few of us were, but he was just like, you know, okay, this is the adventure that it is, you know. It's kind of like, I think he came with with this whole big, you know, real big, you know, extra baggage of just tolerance and you know, relaxedness and the ability to just absorb.
Once high school was over, Barack Obama, like his parents and grandparents before him, began his own journey. But where they had headed west, he now headed east from Hawaii, first to Occidental College in Los Angeles, then to Columbia University in New York, and finally in the very place his mother's parents had escaped, the American Midwest. And where his parents had yearned to escape roots and start anew, the young Obama seemed to be on a different quest. Having bounced from Hawaii to Indonesia and back before he was 10, he apparently longed for the sense of being anchored that comes with roots and memories that predate one's own life. I made a chain between my life and the faces I saw, borrowing other people's memories, he wrote. According to the New Yorker magazine, he wanted to be bound. The quest for steadiness seems to have begun immediately, whatever Obama would say later about his dissolute youth. His fellow students at Occidental have described young Barry Obama as a man who even then showed some of the discipline that has been on display during these last long 2 years. He jogged in the mornings and studied hard, even if he did allow himself the odd joint here and there. Later, his mother confessed herself worried by the barrenness of his Spartan quarters at Columbia. She told him he was living like a monk. Once he had graduated with a degree in political science, specializing in international relations, he cast around for a career. He wrote to various civil rights organizations and black politicians. None wrote back. Eventually, he was offered a job as a community organizer in Chicago, working with those laid off by the drastic decline of the steel industry. In 1985, Barack Obama started work as a community organizer. Through countless meetings on street corners and school gymnasiums, he pulled together a coalition of churches, struggling middle-class residents, and tenants of public housing. He was learning the centrality of preparation and organization to making political change. In 1988, Obama went back to study to another Ivy League institution, this time Harvard Law School. And it was here that his distinctive political style began to form, or at least become apparent. In his second year, Obama was elected to one of the most prestigious posts in American academic life, becoming the first African-American president of the Harvard Law Review. Several profiles of this new rising star appeared in the national press. When Obama returned to Chicago, his reputation had preceded him. Many of the city's top lawyers wanted to recruit him. The Guardian's Daniel Nassau spoke to Judson Minor, a civil rights attorney at the time.
I called him.
And what was the response?
Well, I ended up getting somebody at the Law Review office. He wasn't there. And they asked me if I would like to leave a message. I said, well, I guess so. And they said, well, is this a recruiting call? And I said, I guess so. And they said, would you like to leave your name? And I said, okay. And this young lady said to me, jokingly, well, you're going to be 643rd on the list. I said, fine.
Obama did eventually take the job and worked at the firm as a junior lawyer, working on civil rights cases. Douglas Baird, a professor at the University of Chicago Law School, who was then charged with recruiting new talent, also heard about Obama.
I called him up as a third-year law student and asked him if he had any interest in teaching law, and he said no. And I asked him what his plans were, and he said he was going to come to Chicago and write a book about voting rights. And what I did is suggested, well, maybe you should write that at the University of Chicago. But my thought being that if he did turn out to have an interest in the academy, possession would be 9/10 of the law, and it was relatively costless for us. We just give him a small office and a word processor, and if it worked out, fine. If it didn't work out, it was a relatively costless mistake. And then I remember him coming to my office after he'd been here for about a month, and he said, well, Douglas, you know, I've been working on the book, and it's really not so much a book about voting rights as it is my autobiography. And so it happened that Dreams of My Father was written in this building.
Obama was initially reluctant to commit too much time to the university and was keen to carry on with his work in the community. He led Project Vote, a voter registration drive aimed at African Americans. John Schmidt, former chief of staff to Chicago Mayor Richard Daley, met Obama in late 1991.
I was kind of taken aback that he would be considering spending his time running a voter registration drive. He had just graduated from Harvard Law School. He had an extraordinary record there. He had been the president of the Harvard Law Review, which is the most elite institution at a law school. It was the kind of record that you would have expected him to be clerking for some distinguished judge or working in a big law firm like the one I was in and making a lot of money. Instead, he was going to go out and work on the streets of Chicago registering voters. So I was startled by it.
Project Vote ultimately registered 150,000 new voters. It was experience that stood Obama in remarkably good stead. Not only was he now making contacts with Chicago's political establishment, he learned from the ground up the mechanics and importance of grassroots organization. It was his mastery of this often neglected area of politics that would, come 2008, give Obama the edge over Hillary Clinton and eventually help propel him to the White House. In October 1992, as the project wound up, Obama married Michelle Robinson, who he had met a few years earlier. They married at Jeremiah Wright's Trinity United Church of Christ. By now, Obama had abandoned the agnosticism of his father and the eclectic, pick-and-mix anthropologist's view of religion of his mother. His search for stability had, in part, led him to become a Christian. The 1990s now saw Obama with a portfolio career, working at a civil rights law firm, at an academic institution, and as a community organizer. But politics cooled. Ever since Harvard, if not before, he'd been thinking about how best to effect change. His years as a community organizer had persuaded him that he couldn't do enough at grassroots level. The big decisions were taken by elected politicians. At the University of Chicago, Douglas Baird recalls his own reaction.
The consistent advice I and other people gave him was to not waste his talent. We said that when he told us that he was going to run for the United States Senate, we said, look, you know, Barack, this is crazy, because the best case scenario is you're going to end up in an 8-man field where there's no particular reason to think you're going to win. Forget about politics, give it up, and just join our faculty full time. As much as we wanted him to be a full-time academic and live in the ivory tower, that's just not who he's about. He's a man who's really comfortable in a lot of different worlds and probably someone who would never have been comfortable just being in the academy.
How did he compare on an intellectual level with the other faculty here at the University of Chicago, both at the law school and elsewhere in the university?
This is a man who worked on something like equal terms with anyone at the University of Chicago. This is someone who could walk into the faculty club, which is filled with Nobel laureates. He would sit down and talk, and he wouldn't give quarter to anyone. So he's a man whose intellectual gifts are I wouldn't say completely unprecedented in the history of the presidency, but are certainly unprecedented in the history of modern American politics.
By 1995, Obama had made his decision. He wanted to run for office. Alice Palmer, a popular African-American member of the Illinois State Senate, was vacating her seat so she could run for the U.S. Congress. Obama sought to succeed her in the 1996 election. Her seat included the area where the Obamas were now living, Hyde Park, an uber-liberal neighborhood of Chicago dominated by the university. Politically, it's idiosyncratic, a middle-class island within the less affluent and largely African-American South Side. Don Rose is a veteran Chicago political strategist.
Hyde Park has a long tradition of electing independent political figures. It's a liberal, democratic area, but it is not tied to or controlled in any way by the regular democratic political organization of Chicago, which has always been one of the more tightly controlled organizations, a very, very tight authoritarian political organization known here as the Machine.
Why did his independence from the Machine help him along his political career?
People who are elected from Hyde Park to various offices are people who have built their reputations and risen outside of the control of this frequently corrupt and certainly very powerful political organization. It is a way to rise more rapidly than if one chooses to work within that political machine. If Barack Obama had chosen to move to an adjacent neighborhood in the black community, he could not have run independently as quickly as he has, and not with any success, certainly. He would have had to serve some kind of an apprenticeship with the organization and work his way up in a competitive situation and maybe or maybe not get the nod from the political bosses in that area.
Palmer designated Obama as her successor, guaranteeing him broad support in the district. He cemented his support by holding small get-togethers with neighborhood leaders and potential campaign donors. Lawyer Judson Miner again.
When he started out, there were always concerns that maybe no one would show up at an event, so the campaign used to often call me and ask me if my wife and I and maybe some friends would come just in case no one showed up. And we could leave if they people came. And so that caused us to go to a lot of his events, and we actually had a chance to watch him evolve over the years as a candidate.
In the end, Obama was unopposed and won the seat. Not much has been written about Barack Obama's spell in the state Senate in Springfield, Illinois. And yet, given the brevity of his service in Washington, it remains the clearest guide to his politics. He arrived facing hostility from some African-American colleagues. They taunted him with admissions he had made in his memoir, Dreams from My Father. They said he was a white man in blackface. One time it got so bad, Obama and his antagonists stepped out of the Senate chamber and into a back room where they started shoving each other. Afterwards, the older man never bothered Obama again. Instructive, perhaps, for those who fear the new president will want to solve every dispute with words rather than force. But Obama learned a crucial lesson in Springfield, that progress wouldn't come through smart policy papers or stirring speeches. Relationships were the key. He had to win the trust and support of his colleagues. He headed for the golf course, realizing that that was where the old boys were doing much of the business. When a first round proved a disaster, he took lessons. He joined the senator's poker game. With more skill than luck, says one former player, more cerebral than instinctive, faithfully bringing a six-pack of beers to each game. His poker buddies were all over 50 and all white. Soon, he was earning respect and eyeing a bigger prize. Obama's election to the US Senate in 2004 was the result of a series of lucky breaks. One opponent, then another, fell away thanks to messy divorce scandals. Obama, in the end, ran against a barely credible talk show host, Alan Keyes, and demonstrated he had crossover appeal, that he could reach white as well as black voters. On the day, Obama won with a staggering 70% of the vote. That summer, Obama caught the eye of the John Kerry campaign as they sought a keynote speaker for the 2004 convention.
We gather to affirm the greatness of our nation, not because of the height of our skyscrapers or the power of our military or the size of our economy. Our pride is based on a very simple premise, summed up in a declaration made over 200 years ago. We hold these truths.
His message that there were no red states, no blue states, only the United States, struck a chord, and he became an instant superstar. In January 2005, he was sworn in as a United States Senator, becoming only the third black senator since the end of the American Civil War. Barack Obama once again realized the importance of forging relationships, especially with those who didn't agree with you. Ilana Shaw from The Guardian's Washington Bureau explains.
As a senator, Obama started out being ranked 99th out of 100, and the Democrats were not in control of Congress at that time, so Obama didn't have much power to work with. How did he use his small amount of power? The first thing he did was approach one of the most senior Republicans, Richard Lugar, and say, "I want to write a bill with you. Let's make a bill into law," which was bold for a young man of Obama's age, but he chose a subject that really appealed to both him and the Republican, securing loose nuclear weapons that are often traded on the black market after the Cold War has ended. So Obama and Lugar sit down and write this bill. It sounds small, but it's obviously an issue that impacts everyone worldwide, the idea that loose nukes, as we call them, could fall into terrorist hands, and they got it done fairly quickly. So this established Obama's reputation as somebody who doesn't seek the spotlight, is a bit of a policy wonk, and has no problems approaching Republicans at a time when Democrats like to stick together and we're getting more and more partisan in America.
Mindful of the resentments his high public profile could stir, he vowed to earn the respect of his colleagues. He refused national media interviews, devoting his time instead to getting to know the state he now represented in Washington. Ilana Shaw.
The other very notable aspect of Obama's 2 years in the Senate was that after that famous 2004 convention speech, everyone knew his name. Everyone was banging down his door saying, "Appear on my TV show, endorse this, write this for me." And he ignored all but a very few of those publicity requests. And that modesty really distinguished him from your average Washington politician who, no matter how old he is or what his name is, loves the camera and loves attention.
In the Senate, Obama didn't even attempt the clubbable chumminess he had affected in Springfield. He focused only on the work, returning to the monastic habits of his student days. In the evenings, he would ask his advisers to convene top policy experts for a dinner. Obama would make some introductory remarks, then sit back and listen. He particularly encouraged internal argument among his own advisers, thrashing out both sides of an argument. After 8 years of a president who ostracized any advisers who dared tell him what he didn't want to hear, the Obama style could mark quite a change.
I stand here knowing that my story is part of the larger American story, that I owe a debt to all of those who came before me, and that in no other country on earth is my story even possible.
America's new president is someone who has reflected on himself and his story with often brutal clarity. His autobiography, Dreams from My Father, is searingly honest. Obama is a man who's come to terms with himself, a man unusually comfortable in his own skin. This may explain the extraordinary calm Obama has displayed through the wild campaign journey of these last 2 years. His family is cool and collected too. The Guardian's Zan Rice asked step-grandmother Mama Sarah what she thought about the idea of Barack as president of the most powerful country in the world.
She says it's not a big deal.
It's a trait that his grandfather had for greatness. His father had it, and now he has it. So to her, it's the fact that he's going to become the president is not so much a big deal as that he's able to be the person he is. And she also says that it's a job. At the end of the day, it's a government post. There's a time limit to it. And when that time is over, it's over. So she's not going to make a big deal of it and act as if that it's something really, really great, because he's just doing a job.
Barack Obama has won in part because he ran a campaign that was as steady and unruffled as he is. Its motto, no leaks, no drama. By keeping some part of himself outside the hurly-burly, he seems to avoid drowning in the day-to-day. He can see the bigger picture. He did that in the campaign, almost always putting strategy before tactics. And there's good reason to hope he'll do the same in government. Barack Obama has had a remarkable life. And, incredible as it seems, all that is mere prologue. The story's most remarkable chapter starts today.